The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right, and it is a Wednesday. Oh, I love it when we just make it through the days and the week. Small miracles, I guess, each day. Anyway, we are live at NicoleSandler.com and, of course, on the Progressive Voices Network, streaming audio. We do have video going both on Facebook Live and on Periscope, which is on Twitter. The Twitter just tweeted out the Periscope link, and I see Facebook Live is going. We're still suspended from YouTube. I don't know. I've been trying. It's going to be an ongoing process, I have a feeling. But Universal Music Publishing Group doesn't answer their phone or emails. So I tried calling them out on Twitter yesterday. That usually helps. It didn't do any good yet. We'll keep trying. Anyway, we've got a big and busy show for you today. David Dayen is back. It's been a while since I've spoken to David Dayen. He's really busy these days since he's taken over as executive editor of the American Prospect magazine. And it's one you should read at prospect.org. Really good stuff. And David Dayen's got a new book out called Monopolized. So we'll speak with him in the second half hour of the show. I promise you it's fascinating and a bit depressing, but fascinating nonetheless. We also have the mayor of Miami Beach, Dan Gelber, on the show. And I go way back with Dan. Hadn't spoken to him in a few years, actually. But when I used to work at WINZ in Miami, when it was then a progressive talk station and not South Florida's fifth sports talk station. When I started there, I was the producer of Jim DeFede's morning show. Jim DeFede, of course, from the Miami Herald and now at the CBS-owned station in Miami. And after Jim left, but Dan Gelber and Jim were good friends, so Dan was on the show a lot. So I got to know him pretty well back then. Again, this was, you know, a decade or so ago, or actually longer. Time flies. Anyway, Dan Gelber is now the mayor of Miami Beach. And I got to say, in a sea of crazies in Miami, he's holding down the fort and really trying to keep things under control there. So we'll speak with him in just a few minutes. But you know, I like to start the show with something funny. And, you know, every time Randy Rainbow comes out with a new video, it's always induces laughter, which is what we're looking for. So he does have a new video out today, and the song is a parody of a song from West Side Story. For those of you who don't get the reference, when he does current pop song parodies, I don't know those, but I do know most of the musical references, and this is a good one. So with no further ado, take it away, our friend, yeah, in my dreams, Randy Rainbow.
I don't know, doctor. I've never tried therapy before, let alone over Zoom or whatever. But I just have really been going through a rough time with this pandemic. You know, and I know you're not a shrink, but I just didn't know who else to go to. I mean, my country is a mess. I'm not even talking to it right now. I haven't had a haircut in like 5 months. I mean, I know I still look great. Thank you. But I just feel there's no leadership. And, you know, the president is even attacking you. Can't you stop him?
Oh, no. I don't have the qualifications to do that. I can only give people advice from the standpoint of public health.
Dear darling Dr. Fauci, we know you're smart as hell. You're certainly no slouchy. You made it through Cornell. You fought some bad infections. But now you've hit a wall with the worst infection of them all. Gee, Anthony Fauci, so calm and precise. Your raspy voice is sexy and your glasses are nice. You follow the science on facts, you're a lie. You only want us not to die. What a guy.
What a guy, what a guy, what a lovely guy. Like he only wants us not to die.
Dr. Fauci's made some mistakes.
Sir, COVID cases continue to rise. Why would your administration try to discredit the nation's leading expert on infectious diseases?
It is what it is.
Donald, you're satanic. You should have stayed in Queens while we're in full-on panic. You're honking friggin' beans. The doctors try to save us, but you push them away. Wear your mask just shut up, okay? Hey, Anthony Fauci, he's dragging us south. Forget the mask, just slap some masking tape on his mouth. While you help protect us, he prays it'll pass. He only covers his own ass.
His fat ass.
His own ass.
His own ass. His own big fat ass.
All he tries to save is his own ass.
Ivanka Trump finding herself accused of violating federal ethics laws.
She shared a photo endorsing Goya.
Ivanka, take your Goya and blow it out your pan. I know this might annoy ya, but we ain't got a plan. Your daddy wants to kill us. Your husband's even worse. Help Ivanka, quick, design a purse. Boy, Anthony Fauci, their strategy sucks. They slander all the experts and promote all the schmucks. And still some are buying the garbage they sell. Please save us, Fauci, we're in hell.
We're in hell, 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 hell, hell.
No, like actually, we're all in hell.
The science should not stand in the way of this. Our schools are extremely important. They're essential, and they must reopen. Yes.
Hey, Kaylee, you're a dipstick, and please don't take offense. Have you been eating lipstick? You're making zero sense. You're pushing propaganda. You're acting like a snob. Love your hair, girl. Do your freaking job. Please, Anthony Fauci, we're all at a loss. We can't rely on Barbie and Cruella DeVos. Oh. He's winding them up, and they're playing his tunes. They're all unethical buffoons.
They're buffoons, they're buffoons, they're buffoons. They're all shameless goons. They're depraved, unethical buffoons.
In a way, we're creating trouble.
The trouble is this lady. The trouble is he's mean. The trouble is he's shady. The trouble is this queen. The trouble is she's useless. The trouble's there's no plan.
Dr. Fauci, you're the one we stand. G. Anthony Fauci, we're down on our knees. Hey, girl.
Because no one at the top can help us stop this disease.
Please, Anthony Fauci, hasn't a clue.
Thank you very much.
G. Anthony Fauci, we love you.
I'm convinced of that.
How great. How great is Randy Rainbow? That one was just out of the ballpark. Good stuff. And it helps that I love West Side Story. And by the way, Steven Spielberg is doing a new production of West Side Story for film. I know there's a new Broadway production, too, but a new movie coming out as well. And I hope they don't, you know, screw up the original, because the original was pretty damn good. Anyway, I digress. Yes, he is an amazing artist. Randy Rainbow, what a treat. And yeah, he kind of needs a haircut, but he still looks fabulous. All right. I told you we got a busy show for you today, so I'm not going to wait any longer. Let's get to it. The mayor of Miami Beach. Where are you, Dan Gelber? Mayor of Miami Beach, Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for being here today.
Happy to be here, Nicole. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too. It's been a long time. It was, what, over 10 years ago when you used to frequently guest on the Jim DeFede Show when I was producer on WINZ in Miami when we had a progressive talk station in South Florida. Seems like a lifetime ago.
Things aren't quite as progressive as they used to be.
No, unfortunately, but hopefully we can change that. So I haven't spoken to you, obviously, since you've become mayor of Miami Beach. So congratulations, I think, because what a time to be mayor of a big city. First of all, dealing with the pandemic, with COVID-19. And in Miami-Dade County, it seems like you're almost out there alone, surrounded by a lot of elected officials who don't seem to want to acknowledge reality.
Well, it's interesting. The breakdown goes something like this. The local government gets it because we have to, you know, we sort of see it. State government, I think, is not getting it. And the federal government has been the worst. What's really gone on in this thing is, I don't know if you're old enough, Nicole, to remember the Mikey commercial with
Life Cereal. Mikey, he'll eat anything.
Cereal.
Yeah.
So
I'm old enough.
What happened? Yeah, I knew that.
I know.
What basically happens now is the federal government is not, certainly President Trump has not wanted to make a tough call. He's not wanted to tell people what they don't want to hear. He wants to give good news and not bad news. So he sort of pushed to the governors all of the obligations to tell, you know, residents that you've got to wear masks, you got to be socially distanced, to close things down, you can't go to restaurants or maybe even beaches. So they pushed that to the governors. And in our state, the governor sort of pushed it down the table to the kids sitting at the end of the table, which turns out to be the mayors and commissioners, and giving them the job to sort of deliver the bad news or to ask people to take the difficult medicine. And so we've been doing that. And I have found a lot of my colleagues, Democrats and Republicans, frankly, have been pretty good about trying to get it right. But we've gotten no help with regard to that part of the leadership equation, really from obviously from the president, and a much limited amount from the governor, who has sort of just left it to us, but won't even implement a mask order, which would probably make our jobs a lot easier.
Yeah, I've in the tradition of Donald Trump, I've come up with a nickname for our governor. Instead of Ron DeSantis, he's Ron Death Sentence. You don't have to laugh at that, but I think it's funny because if we don't laugh, we cry. Should we have a mandatory mask policy here in the state of Florida?
Of course we should. We should have one nationally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here's what's going on. And you got to really think about it this way. You know, right now we're trying to control the spread of a virus that has 2 to 3 week lagging indicators. So whatever we do now, we're stuck with baked into the system. And so it's very hard politically to tell people wear a mask now so that you don't have a problem in 2 to 3 weeks. It's hard to prove a negative didn't happen. So it really requires a level of leadership and courage, because you're asking people to make a sacrifice that you're never going to be able to prove to them was necessary if it works.
Right.
And instead, we're waiting for all of the numbers to go up, the virus to spike. And then we're saying, okay, now we'll shelter in place and now we'll wear a mask. But of course, by that point, the thousands of people that have tested positive, a percentage of that surge is going to be in the hospital, and a smaller percentage will be in intensive care, and a smaller percentage, but all significant numbers, will be on ventilators. And about half of those people will perish. So it's become really this terrible cycle of both medicine and a lack of leadership that we're in right now. And if we had a mask order, well, then we would be sending a message to people that they need to take care of this. And I am certain that the governor and the president have a certain number of people, maybe about a third, who will listen to them, mm-hmm. When not other people like me. I'm spending the last week, we put our mask order in the day the CDC said, put a mask on. We did it that day. Minutes after April 3rd, we put in a mandatory mask order indoors and some places outdoors. And since then, we've expanded it and added fines and things like that. And for the 109 days or 10 days since that April 3rd order, I've been almost fighting with people who don't want to wear it, don't think they need to wear it, think it's a political statement, think I'm a communist because I want them to wear a mask, or a fascist, depends upon what group I'm talking to. And it would be a lot easier if we all got on the same page. And I guess that's my biggest concern, is that the failure of the governor to say, wear a mask or be fined, the failure of the president to say, wear a mask, it's important and patriotic, and sort of said it yesterday, but barely.
Yeah, kind of.
Until all that happens, we're fighting with people. And in any other natural disaster, like a hurricane, we all get on the same page and we tell people, hunker down or leave town or whatever we tell them to do. And when someone doesn't evacuate, nobody says, well, I don't think you need to.
Right. That's personal choice. Right.
It's just sort of like it's a science medical health-based decision. It's too dangerous to be in your house because we think meteorologically the hurricane's coming here. Well, we think it's too dangerous to not wear a mask in public for the community you live in. So I don't get it. I think it would help immensely. But I guess right now the president and the governor would like to be the people that open up everything, and they'd like us to be the ones who deliver the news about having to swallow tough medicine, which I'm prepared to do. But at least I wish they would not give messaging that you don't need to take the medicine.
Right.
That doesn't help me do my job.
No, not at all. And again, we're speaking with Dan Gelber. He's the mayor of Miami Beach. For those who are not in South Florida, they may not get the distinction. Miami Beach is definitely separate from the city of Miami. And, you know, the hospitals in Miami-Dade County, where I'm in Broward, we're hearing the ICUs are filled to like 122% of capacity, at least most of them. We had a stay-at-home order for about a month, and people pretty much stuck to it. I'm still staying at home up here because I prefer to be safe. Do you think that we might get to the point where we need another stay-at-home order? Would you consider doing that? Could you do it in Miami Beach alone if the rest of the county doesn't do it?
My manager and our commission could issue. We were the first city. We sheltered in home. We had the order before any other city in Florida.
Wow.
Same thing with our mask order. We've sort of been ahead. We closed our beaches before anybody else. And we were also the last to open everything up, even though they opened up the state. And in fact, the county a little bit later, we waited 2 weeks after that, along with the city of Miami, to actually start opening other things up. So we've been pretty slow. We've been quick to respond and slow to emerge. But of course it doesn't really matter with this virus because it's pernicious and the compliance has been spotty, to say the least. To answer your question, well, of course we're going to consider it because, you know, it's a very interesting thing. And I think about this a lot because these are decisions I never thought as a mayor I'd be deciding and talking about mass casualty issues
right.
like this, but that's what they really are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the issues has been that hospital capacity was presented to us at the beginning of this by the CDC as sort of a hard stop in terms of if you don't have any more ventilators, if you don't have any more PPE, if you don't have enough intensive care beds, you've got to shelter in place because we know that stops the spread and that's how you protect your hospital system's ability to care for people. Well, you know, what has happened over the last 3 or 4 months is we have increased our hospital capacity. So right now we have plenty of ventilators.
Mm-hmm.
We can convert intensive care beds. We're past our limit, but we can convert them if we can find the staff for them and the staff can stay healthy themselves because there's a lot of burnout and peril in being a medical professional.
Absolutely.
So we could probably increase our capacity greatly. But at some point, we have to say to ourselves, that's not really the goal here. Because if the goal is to simply be able to process more people down this assembly line of bad stuff, then we've forgotten that this is human suffering that's happening. It's not just about being efficient in providing care, but more importantly, about stopping people from needing the care in the first place. And so I've been sort of talking to the other mayors pretty regularly about saying one of the metrics can't be the only metric, the hospital capacity, because
right.
we get good at it. All that means is that we've now, you know, doubled the number of people on ventilators. Well, half of those are going to die. So that's not a good thing. So I guess my point is that the most important thing to me is that we stop the spread of the virus and we bring it down. And if we have to shelter in place because we can't do it through any other means, we will. By the way, if everybody wore a mask and everybody exercised physical distancing,
wouldn't need to.
And everybody got on the same page, I don't think we would need to ever shelter
yeah.
in place. But that's not been happening. So it may be we need to soon.
Wow. And Dan Gelber, at the beginning, when I said I'm not sure if I should congratulate you or not, because you have some unique challenges as mayor of Miami Beach. That is, we are now in hurricane season. And if there were not a pandemic going on, the prospect of a major storm hitting South Florida is really dangerous. As it is at high tide, many of the streets in Miami Beach are underwater. Miami Beach is basically a barrier island. This is with climate change and everything else. This is really scary times. What kind of plans do you have in place should a major storm come our way in the next month?
Well, you touched upon both short and long term
mm-hmm.
challenges. The
mm-hmm.
short term challenge of a hurricane season during a pandemic is pretty daunting.
Yeah.
We have already spoken with the head of emergency management for the state. In fact, he appeared at our last city commission meeting to talk precisely about what's being done and what plans are being made. I mean, we've got to be aware of the fact that we have populations, some that are more infirm than others because of this. We've got vulnerable populations that need to be moved possibly, you know, and that are typically ones that we have to move because they're hard to reach, you know, if there is an evacuation. So they are looking at where you bring people during a pandemic, how you test them quickly so you could put a group presumably in a hotel somewhere on another coast where they would be safe. So those are the things we're thinking about, because typically we can't just send everybody to a shelter. Mm-mm. Because if you send a vulnerable population there, you've got amazing problems. And so that's going to be the challenge, I think, more than anything, is how we protect vulnerable populations in a storm when we would typically move them somewhere. And they've always been of concern. We saw tragically how many perished when they were sent to places that lost electricity and, you know, and and it was too hot, and eventually they died needlessly. Yep. I mean, so that's what we have to avoid. But we are planning for it. On the long term, I have a resiliency meeting with my commission on Friday. We're not stopping. We've been leading on this. We're raising our streets. We're putting pumps in. We're doing what we need to do. We are a barrier island built out of limestone. The water just comes right up. We have sunny day flooding. But yep. where we have raised streets, and we've raised about 6 miles of streets, we don't have sunny day flooding or even as much flooding when there are rain events. So we know the system we have is working. We just have to continue and not stop our effort to enhance our resiliency.
Well, Dan Gelber, I don't envy you what you have on your plate right now, but I'm glad you're there handling it. So I'm thankful for that. The other thing, and, you know, I remember when you were toying with the idea of running for the Senate. Now you've been in the state Senate, you've been in the state House, you're now the mayor of Miami Beach. In 2 years, we need to get rid of our governor. Any chance you might want to jump into that fray?
Listen, I'm really happy. I love being at home. I still have a kid in high school. Mm-hmm. I love being in my community. I'm very happy here. I've spent time in Tallahassee. It's you know, people just assume if there's a higher office that everyone in political life wants to get it. And the truth of the matter is, there are a lot of other things that, you know, give me satisfaction and give me and being around my wife, being around my children who are around the house all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Now. And I have 2 college age daughters. So, you know, frankly, running anything would be easy when you've gone through teenagers.
I hear you. We have kids the same age. Mine turned 21 in quarantine. So she's here too. Yeah.
I like being at home and I like being in my community. And you know, I don't like what is happening statewide right now, but I feel very privileged. I know it's a hard hand everybody's been dealt, but you know, it's not harder for me. In fact, it's easier for me because I can afford some of the things that a lot of people can't afford right now. And so, you know, frankly, the decisions are very difficult. But the, you know, if someone said, and then whenever anybody says, I'm sorry you have to go through this, I think to myself, I'm fortunate, much more fortunate than virtually so many other people who are unemployed, who have food insecurity, have health insecurity. Mm-hmm. So for me, I feel very blessed and privileged that I have this job. So, Nicole, thanks for getting back with you.
Thank you so much. It's great to catch up with you. And hopefully when things calm down, we can spend more time. I really appreciate you jumping on with us today to fill us in on what's going on. And I really appreciate the job you're doing. Dan Gelber, mayor of Miami Beach. You're awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Dan Gelber. He's one of the good guys. I always liked Dan. Again, he and Jim DeFede were really good friends, so I got to know him pretty well back in, well, let's see, I was let go from WINZ the Friday before the Democratic National Convention started in 2008. So, I mean, I've spoken to Dan since then, but it's been a while. Anyway, I'm thrilled that he's the mayor of Miami Beach, and hopefully he will run for a larger role, because he's one of the few mayors down here who's doing a good job, or at least trying to. All right, we've got David Dayen coming up. We've got some news to get to, but we got to take a quick time out. So we'll take that quick break and then come back on the other side with David Dayen of the American Prospect and his new book, Monopolized. It's Nicole Sandler Show at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
As directed by their big business funders, top Republican office holders across the country have been defying public health experts in past weeks to rush America's workers back into their jobs. But oops, the microscopic COVID-19 turns out to be smarter and stronger than Trump and all the money-grubbing CEOs combined. So their impetuous back-to-work commands have backfired, causing the crisis to surge again, killing thousands more Americans. What to do now? Why, of course, get Congress to protect them. Not protect workers and customers, but protect corporate profits. Thus, the White House, such congressional sleazes as Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell and the whole army of Gucci-wearing corporate lobbyists are pushing furiously to pass a law decreeing that corporations cannot be held liable for profit-driven actions and negligence that sicken and kill untold numbers of Americans. Crying crocodile tears for those giants, Trump's corporate-hugging economic advisor wailed, "You've got to give business some confidence here that if something happens, you can't take them out of business. You can't throw big lawsuits at them." Gosh, thanks for your little moral lecture, but what about giving workers, their families, and society in general some confidence that if something happens, you can't take away people's basic human right to pursue justice? Besides, why shouldn't we the people hold these economic powerhouses legally accountable? By preemptively giving a blanket pardon to corporate entities for causing deadly harm, you'll give direct financial incentive to their executives to forego investing in protective measures for workers and public health. Indeed, the very fact they're insisting on a law to shield them is an admission that they know the rush to restart their profit machine will sicken and kill others. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's not just greedy, it's inhumane.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
The Medical Office of Dr. Debbie Birx is here for all of your health concerns with creative medicine, treating the health of patients in a very creative way.
Doctor, I think I got symptoms of coronavirus.
Take your clothes off and stick your tongue out the window.
What will that do?
I'm mad at my neighbor.
Dr. Birx provides compassionate, patient-centered care.
You're pregnant.
How does a man get pregnant?
The usual way. A little wine, a little dinner.
She specializes in care for people of all ages.
You'll live to be 60.
I am 60.
See, what did I tell you?
Doctor, my leg hurts. What can I do?
Limp. Yes.
Excuse me, doctor. The man you just gave a clean bill of health just dropped dead right as he was leaving the office.
Turn him around. Make it look like he was walking in.
Dr. Birx can provide treatment for a diverse range of ailments.
Are you a psychiatrist?
Yes.
Oh, good. Nobody listens to me.
Next.
Can you help me, doctor? I'm a mechanic.
Good. Get under my couch.
Let Dr. Birx prescribe a happy, healthier life.
Oxychloroquine. Hey, I have a heart condition. This poison will kill me.
You're crazy.
Well, if you don't mind, I want a second opinion.
Okay, you're ugly too.
Dr. Birx advises all of her patients to be creative.
Doctor, what do you make of all these scarves?
I can make a hat, a brooch, a pterodactyl.
Dr. Debbie Birx. She doesn't have to practice medicine. She knows it.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
All right. David Dayan will be joining us in a few minutes, but there are a few news stories I got to get to. I don't have time for the entirety of what's news. For that, you can go to NicoleSandler.com and click on what's news and you'll get it. There's an extended version today because there's a lot of news going on. I guess we should start with the news that's broken since I recorded What's News this morning, and that is, as if the images out of Portland aren't bad enough, Donald Trump announced today that he's sending his brown shirts to Chicago. Yep. Trump said the FBI, Drug Enforcement Administration, U.S. Marshals Service, and Department of Homeland Security would all send agents to Chicago. In response, Chicago's Mayor Lori Lightfoot has urged Trump not to send federal agents into the city, imploring the White House to instead focus on initiatives to curb gun violence that has long plagued her town. But this is just the beginning. This is frightening stuff. Now, it's been just about 2 months since the murder of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. And protests still continue around parts of the country, most notably in Portland, Oregon, where the protests are happening nightly. There have been 43 federal arrests since July 4th. The Trump administration, of course, sent in, well, federal agents, I guess. We don't know because they're not identified as to who they are. They're wearing camouflage. They're carrying long guns and tear gas and other military-style weapons. And they only have patches that say police. No badge, no number, no division, no name. Right? And these people are carrying out what appear to be extrajudicial abductions and arrests without probable cause or warrants of protesters, just plucking them off the streets. Now, on Fox so-called news, Judge Andrew Napolitano made it very clear that these actions are unconstitutional.
The federal government can use federal assets to protect federal property. Stated differently, the Department of Homeland Security can send police into Oregon to protect federal courthouse in Oregon. Use that as an example. But they can't enforce the general criminal law. They can't supplement or replace the police. They can't go throughout the streets and say, hey, you're committing a crime, we're going to arrest you. They certainly can't do what they've been doing in Oregon, which is arresting people without a warrant and without probable cause, holding them for a few hours and then letting them go. So they have to be restrained and they have to confine their activity to the federal property. Their law enforcement duties must absolutely be confined to the protection of federal assets. So says the Constitution, which leaves the general police power in the hands of the cities and states the federal government.
So that was Judge Napolitano saying, no, this is not okay. This is not constitutional. Yet, I guess unless someone fights it and fights it successfully, he's going to keep doing this. This is something we need to pay close attention to. And I don't know who is the right person to, take care of the situation, but something's got to give. Anyway, all right. I see we have our guest on the line. David Dayan is the executive editor of The American Prospect. He's also the author of now two books. The first one was the quintessential story of the foreclosure crisis that I'm still waiting for the movie version to come out of, called Chain of Title. The new one just released yesterday is called Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. David Dayan, welcome back to the show and congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm waiting for you to direct the movie.
I don't think you want that. But I have been living your subject still after all these years. So enough of that. Something for another time. The new book, though, I got to tell you that you do what you did with Chain of Power in that you tell stories. You take what could be really, in some instances, dry. Oh, no sound. Hold on. No sound on the video. I got to fix this. Sorry, you guys. Why? Okay. What? Oh, there we go. I see what happened.
Am I here?
You're here. And the sound is back now. Sorry, video listeners. My fault. By the way, are you on camera? You want to turn on the video? Because you can't do video.
I can't do it right now.
No worries. No worries. I've got your picture up, and I've got a picture of the book title, Monopolize, or the book cover up there. But what I started to say before I got so rudely interrupted by no sound is that you tell stories, what could be really dry subject matter, you tell us by way of human stories, and it brings us into it. It makes it so relatable, and it makes it a really good read. So congratulations again.
Yeah, I mean, that was the idea, that there have been a lot of books about this problem of increasing concentration of the economy, of different parts of the economy, over the last 40 years. And a lot of them tell the history of it. They talk about, you know, what happened in Washington to make this happen. They talk about, you know, really kind of, as you say, dry subjects like who has what market share and things like that. But I thought what was missing was talking to people about how this affects them in their everyday life. And, you know, I mean, a chain of title was one story that weaved through the entire book. This book is a series of episodic stories, one for each sector of the economy, where I talked to someone whose life was really directly affected by the fact that we have all these monopolies all over the place throughout different parts of the economy. So, you know, I talked to people who are affected by the airline monopoly, mm-hmm. or the agriculture monopoly, or Facebook and Google, or Amazon, or, you know, just on down the line. And it's not just, hey, I have to pay a little more for my cable, or I have to, you know, do this or do that with prices, because we're more than consumers. It's about us as workers. It's about us as entrepreneurs. It's about our democracy. It's about, you know, so many other things beyond just prices.
Right.
And so that's, I really wanted to get into how our lives are governed by these large corporations.
Right. And I love the way you have the book set up. The chapters, the titles are quite compelling, too. They are all phrased as monopolies are why, whatever. Right. For instance, you mentioned the airlines. Monopolies are why people keep developing deep vein thrombosis on long haul flights. So I guess that works. In a subject in the chapter on telecom and cable and internet, it's monopolies are why students sit in Starbucks parking lots to do their homework. And they do. I mean, you tell some crazy stories. I know that it's frustrating for me that I'm sitting here in Coral Springs, Florida, and our only choice for cable television is AT&T, DirecTV. Sure. Now, you have no it's a monopoly. You can go to the next town over and they may have Comcast, but they can't get DirecTV. You know, they can't get AT&T. I thought we had antitrust laws. I thought we had laws against monopolies. Didn't we break up AT&T years ago for that purpose?
Yeah. I thought we had those laws too, but you come back to it 40 years later and you find that laws are just pretty words on a piece of paper if the enforcement doesn't exist. And so what we did was about 40 years ago, the enforcement completely changed in how we looked at mergers and monopolies. It was changed mostly by Robert Bork, who we remember as the former failed Supreme Court justice under Reagan, but his true achievement was reinterpreting the Sherman Antitrust Act such that it effectively became a non-functional entity. And as a result, we have all of these things. So, you know, the one chapter you described is about rural broadband and the fact that in so many parts of the country, the AT&T and Comcast and these other this very small segment of broadband providers just won't go out there. They won't spend the money, and they don't want anyone else to either. You know, I went to Chattanooga, Tennessee, which has the best broadband service in the country and maybe the world.
That's amazing to me. Chattanooga,
super fast broadband that has revitalized their entire city and brought innovation and 3D printing is a huge industry in Chattanooga, Tennessee, because they have this super fast hookup. But it's done through the public utility, the Electric Power Board, which is like a Tennessee Valley Authority entity. But in Tennessee, AT&T and Comcast got a law passed that says the public utilities can't go past their service area in order to deliver broadband through fiber optic cable. So if you go 3 minutes outside the city limits of Chattanooga, you have dial-up again.
Oh, wow.
And it's just this incredible contrast. You have this is you're literally minutes away from the fastest broadband in the world, and you're going to a Starbucks parking lot to catch the Wi-Fi so your kid can finish his homework. It's incredible.
And that's the monopolies are why students sit in Starbucks parking lots to do their homework. It is a stunning story. And the fact that Chattanooga, Tennessee has great broadband, you know, I hear that in Europe and other countries, they have really fast internet service. We are once again bringing up the rear so much for.
Right. It's not a technology problem. Huh. Right? We have the ability to do it in the United States. We're proving the concept that we can get this done. Interestingly, it plays in with for-profit utility monopolies, because the only groups that are willing to do community broadband in this fashion have public utilities. Duke Energy or Exelon or these large private utility companies, they aren't interested in doing it. That's something in the book I call country club monopolism, where the monopolists in the energy industry don't want to be badmouthed by the monopolists in the telecom industry when they go to the country club. So, wow. There's this certain sense of these various monopolists in different sectors working in concert to protect their interests and protect their businesses.
It's astounding, but obviously this is how things work here, or don't work, as the case may be. David Dayan is our guest. His new book, just out yesterday, is called Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. You've got one. Let me see if I can find this. I've got it on my Kindle, and I'm getting old, and the print is small. It's one about the chapter about, here we go. Monopolies are why hospitals can give patients prosthetic limbs and artificial hearts, but not salt and water in a bag. Now, you wrote this before we got hit with this coronavirus pandemic, but the problems you talk about in this chapter are just magnified now as we're dealing with this across the country, right? What's going on with our medical care?
Yeah, that's really unbelievable. And we actually put an excerpt from that chapter up at the American Prospect today. So you can check that out.
Yes, I will link to it from my blog as well.
Maybe you like it, maybe then you buy the book.
Yes.
But yes, this was written well before the pandemic, but this issue was ever present. So in 2017, there was a hurricane, Hurricane Maria, right mm-hmm. by you, mm-hmm. That took out large sections of Puerto Rico. It turns out that half of all IV bags in the world, really, are made in Puerto Rico. That's where they're manufactured. This company called Baxter that owns half the market, all of their facilities are in Puerto Rico, and they got knocked out by the hurricane. And so you had the situation at the end of 2017 where people were going into hospitals and being told we're out of IV solutions, salt and water in a bag. And this one individual in La Jolla, California, his wife had to get chemotherapy by the nurse manually putting it in through a syringe, which is a technique that was used like in World War II era.
Wow.
But he had to watch this for a half hour for this very delicate technique for chemotherapy. What's so interesting about that is he's in La Jolla in this cancer center, and there's this huge bank of windows, and he's looking out onto the Pacific Ocean, which is all salt and water. And he's being told there is no salt and water. We cannot get salt and water into a bag for you. What's the superbly interesting thing about that, when I really started delving into the issue, is that IV bags were experiencing shortages for years, even before the hurricane came about. And the reason is the contracting relationships that hospitals have with the way they get supplies. There are these middlemen called group purchasing organizations, and they narrow who the suppliers are to sole source contracts. And a sole source contract means any disruption, somebody's out sick or whatever, will create a shortage. And in a capitalist society, we're, I guess, supposed not to have shortages, because if somebody wants something, then there's somebody else who will give it to them. But these middlemen and the way in which the relationships are set create this these shortages, not only in IV bags, but in all kinds of supplies, in prescription drugs and routine drugs, generic drugs that are used in hospitals every day. And there's this guy named Philip Zweig, and he has an outfit called Physicians Against Drug Shortages. And he is like on this lonely crusade to talk about these group purchasing organizations that nobody knows about, these middlemen that have created this real fragility within supply chains. And of course, the pandemic has made it worse. And what that signifies is how monopolies create this hidden risk in the system. When you only have two or three airlines, or when you only have this one channel for where the supply chain goes through, if something breaks down, all of a sudden, the risk in the system of having these shortages or having just delays or whatever becomes super magnified. If there are 20 people that make IV bags, then if one of them goes down, it's not a problem. If there's only one, then suddenly you have a big problem. And mm-hmm. that's what monopoly power ends up creating. It's a side effect.
Wow. And we're seeing it in every sector of life. You know, a story caught my eye a couple of days ago. And I've been sort of wondering, who do I talk to about this? And it turns out, David Dayan, with the subject of this book, you're probably the perfect person. And it's the story of, I don't know if you know this guy's name, John Malone. Have you heard of him?
Of Liberty Media?
Liberty Media. You got it. Liberty. Here's the headline. Live Nation, iHeartRadio, SiriusXM, Ticketmaster, and Pandora are now all under the control of one man. I mean, we screamed about Sinclair Media, Sinclair Broadcasting, when they were trying to take over a lot of the Tribune television stations. And thankfully, that deal got pushed away. I guess he just got the approval to take on a majority share of it's iHeartMedia, actually, not just iHeartRadio, because they're bigger than just the radio company. This is really dangerous stuff. And I'm a product of the consolidation crisis in radio. I mean, I've been radio for 40 years, but there are no decent jobs anymore, except for a very small handful, because of the consolidation under the Telecommunications Act of 1996, but it's a monopoly. We've got like three companies that own most radio stations.
Absolutely. And that story is actually in the book. Delve in there in the journalism chapter, there is a section on talk radio and how the use of Clear Channel and how it sort of trended towards right-wing talk and how mm-hmm. left-wing talk was shut out of the system. I talked to Brad Friedman and Peter B. Collins, mm-hmm. and that part, there's a little section of that in the book. But what you bring up is absolutely salient, because what you're looking at is what they would call a vertical integration. So now you have the radio stations in the hands. iHeartMedia used to be Clear Channel, and now it's iHeartMedia.
That's right.
So that's 600 some odd radio stations. Now you have satellite radio, which is supposed to be the alternative to terrestrial radio, and now it's in the hands of the same person.
Right.
You have streaming radio. iHeartRadio is a streaming outlet, and Pandora. Mm-hmm. So the guy has two of the competitors within the system, Spotify being the big one, but he's like number two in that market. And you have Live Nation, which does the concerts. So this is like every point on the chain in terms of music and entertainment, live entertainment anyway.
Right.
He is in control of.
Yes, and I believe, didn't SiriusXM just purchase Spotify? Oh, that was Stitcher. No. That was Stitcher. Sorry, got confused. But still,
Spotify is trying to corner the market on
podcasting.
Market. That's a whole other story. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And what we saw happen in the blog community, where it finally got like sort of mustered out because of Google and Facebook.
Yeah.
Spotify's trying to do the same thing in the podcasting community. So that's a really interesting story that's happening right now. But, you're talking about If you are a Live Nation supported artist, because they manage artists, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could get your radio play on an iHeartRadio station.
Yep.
You could have your concert venues be promoted by Live Nation.
Yep.
You could
sold
put them into venues that are owned by Live Nation.
Mm-hmm.
You could have your new album stream on Pandora, which is owned by the same person, and you could have an entire channel dedicated to it at SiriusXM, also owned by the same person. So this
right
is
and the tickets thing. And the tickets sold by Ticketmaster, who also owned by the same guy.
Right, exactly. And Ticketmaster, that's a whole part of the, there's a chapter on Ticketmaster in the book, a small chapter. I have these sort of interludes in the book that describes sort of my experiences walking through and sort of being punched in the face by Monopoly over and over again when I'm traveling. Like the perfect example is I was waiting for a bus in San Francisco and I found myself at the Bank of America Plaza at Zuckerberg General Hospital.
Oh, God.
So, you know, I mean, this is like the ultimate Monopoly spot in America.
Wow.
But one of the chapters about Ticketmaster, which is this huge monopoly, and Live Nation and Ticketmaster merged under Obama, and it was shocking to everyone that this merger was able to get through until you realize that the chief of staff of Obama, Rahm Emanuel, his brother was on the board of Live Nation at the time.
Right.
So, it's really. What you're talking about with John Malone and Liberty Media is really an example of what you see in sector after sector of the economy. These people who are scooping up large areas where you can escape them, possibly if you want to engage in buying that good or service. And it's really dangerous for a lot of reasons. It's dangerous in this case for artists who can't break into that cycle.
Mm-hmm.
It's dangerous for independent radio producers like yourself.
Yep.
It's dangerous for a whole host of people, and it's bad for listeners, and it's bad for democracy.
Right, and across the board, David Day, in every sector that you write about in the book Monopolized, it seems like with this pandemic, things are only going to get worse because a lot of small businesses will not be able to survive the long run, especially if we have another shutdown, which it looks like we're probably going to need. So the big guys are going to swallow them up, making way for more monopolies.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
We seem to have a lag. Sometimes the internet does weird things when we're doing a live interview. So you're breaking up on me a little bit. You know, we're getting close to the end of the hour. I want to ask, the last chapter is called Monopolies or Why I Travel to Chicago.
Is that hello?
Yeah, no, I'm here. I lost you for a moment there. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm here. I was just going to say that on Monday, I think it was Amazon.
Oh, we're having a weird internet.
Netflix,
thing. Yeah.
Facebook, Google, and Microsoft sign up. Oh, no. Can you hear me?
Yeah. We have a weird internet electronic buffering thing going on. So you said something on Monday, Netflix, Google, Facebook, and something. That's all I heard. Uh-oh. It seems like the internet is backed up on us.
You look at these big tech firms and their stock prices rose such that I was just going to say they increased the market share by $291 billion in a day.
Oh, my God.
Those six companies. So the market sees the writing on the wall that these certain companies were sort of the winners after the pandemic because of, you know, changes in our consumer patterns in retail, changes in working from home are going to be the big winners in the economy. They know that they're just going to skyrocket in terms of income.
Wow.
Over the next several months and years. It was dangerous already to have these big tech firms, but now it's even worse.
Yeah, with the internet, with the pandemic, the big behemoths are getting bigger as the little guys are unfortunately going to die off, or so it seems. I want to ask you, this is all very disconcerting. It's upsetting. But your last chapter, chapter 12, is called Monopolies Are Why I Traveled to Chicago and Tel Aviv to Learn How to Stop Them. Did you learn how to stop them, and can we do it?
I did learn, and you know, it was as unfavorable an environment as there is in the world when you're talking about the environment in Israel just about a decade ago with respect to their economy. I mean, we only hear about Israel in terms of the Palestinian situation, but
right.
They had a terribly concentrated economy. They had these tycoons that owned these interlocking corporations that would have 60 different sectors in the economy under one roof. And there was a movement that began through journalism, through a website called The Marker, which was affiliated with Haaretz, and eventually spilled out onto the street. There were these protests against high food prices and high housing prices, and it put 500,000 people into the streets of Israel in 2012.
Wow.
This is a country of 11 million or so. So this is a significant portion of the total population that was protesting this. And eventually they got around to understanding that the people standing in the way here were the tycoons. That was the impediment to this economic inequality and deprivation within Israel. And in a Netanyahu government, in a right-wing government, there were changes to their laws that not only were there changes in enforcement that put a lot of these tycoons in jail, but there were changes to competition laws such that the telecom system, the cell phone market, was changed so much that cell phone rates went down 90%. In the country of Israel. And wow. And Israel is now today much less concentrated than it was then. And it took a social movement on the streets in order to do that. Now, we have a social movement here that is happening on the streets that we've had for the last 2 months.
Yeah.
So it's not impossible to rouse people and to understand, you know, the factors that are contributing to inequality and stagnant wages and all of the various harms and challenges within our country, and to motivate them to get out and agitate for real change. It takes a movement, however. That's what it took in the progressive era when things like the Sherman Act were actually created.
Right.
It took the Granger movement, which was a movement of farmers, and it took movements of small businesses to get anti-chain store laws passed in the 1930s and 40s. And, you know, so we have a history of this. It's been proven in other countries in more recent times, and we can do it again. But it does take a movement. And what I hope is that my book and others like it can give the information that people need to build that movement.
Well, I hope so, too. Again, it's just out. It was officially released yesterday. It is called Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. It's written by David Dayen, who you should follow on Twitter at ddayen and D-A-Y-E-N, and read him at the American Prospect. I can't not comment on that. It's been about a year since you took over as executive editor, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been about a year, and we are putting out great content every day.
You are.
And we're excited about you know, what we've been able to do over the last year. I feel like we're just hitting our stride, and we're just going to get better and better. So prospect.org is where you can find that.
Absolutely. You guys are doing great work over there. And again, you've always been quite prolific. I don't know how you wrote this book and spent the last year just taking on the new responsibility of running the American Prospect and still keeping a full slate of stories that you're working on. You amaze me all the time. David Dayen, thank you so much. The book is great. Obviously, I'm not through with it yet. I got to hone in on that chapter on journalism. And the title of it is great as well. If I can find it, it was Monopolies Are Why Hundreds of Journalists Became Filmmakers, Then Back to Writers, Then Unemployed. makes sense. David Dane, thank you so much. Great stuff. And I'm really excited to read the rest of it. And it's always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your support.
You got it. Take care. Bye-bye. David Dayen, again, follow him on Twitter at DDAYEN, and check out The American Prospect. He's really, I mean, it was always a good magazine, but he's made it even better at prospect.org. And with that, we're done. Tomorrow is Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. And on Friday, we have a video to premiere. You know, I like to start the show with something funny. Well, Harry Shearer, he of Spinal Tap fame and The Simpsons and everything else, has a lot of albums under his belt. He's got a new one coming out. It's something like The Many Faces of Donald Trump. And the first video is called Son-in-Law. And we can play it on Friday because that's the day it comes out. So, still got a week ahead of us. Thank you for listening, everyone. And sorry about the streaming issues. We're working on it. Have a great one. Thank you for listening. See you tomorrow. Bye.